This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. $25,000. That's how much a political action committee supporting Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi received from Donald Trump as she was running for re-election. Now she's facing growing questions and calls for an investigation over that money and her decision not to join an investigation into alleged fraud at Trump University. The Associated Press this week reported Bondi was personally involved asking for the donation, which came from a nonprofit Trump Family Foundation. Now, that itself may be in violation of a ban on charities making political contributions. Bondi says there was no connection between the $25,000 donation and her ultimate decision not to join the Trump University investigation.
At Trump University, we teach success. That's what it's all about, success. It's going to happen to you.
Bondi said this week there's no basis for her office to open that investigation. The New York Attorney General and a class action lawsuit, though, filed in California, alleged Trump University defrauded students. Now, Bondi was one of the first elected officials and prominent women in Florida to endorse Trump for president. Here she is on Fox News Channel back in March.
I choose my endorsements in a very different way, in a personal way. And I look at the person, and that's what's important to me. And I never want to lose that in me. I've known Donald. I see a different Donald Trump, I think, than a lot of people see.
So money in politics starts us off here this week on the Florida Roundup. How does money influence your support for a presidential candidate? Should politics and the law not mix at all? They clearly are, though, in this election. Join the conversation here, Politics and Money in the State of Florida, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Look for us at WLRN. Steve Bosquet covers all things political statewide for the Tampa Bay Times. Matt Dixon does much the same from Politico, both of them joining us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Steve, let's begin with you. The controversy over the Bondi, the Trump donation to Bondi dates back to the last election cycle. What did the Associated Press find this week, and how did it find it?
Yes, thanks, Tom. You know, the donation is not new. It was reported on 3 years ago. There were some new details in the AP story. Most noteworthy, I think, is the fact that a political consultant who does work for Pam Bondi, a guy named Mark Reicheldurfer, did confirm for the first time that Bondi personally solicited the contribution. That was one new detail. And, you know, the other point is that Bondi did this to Trump. But the contribution from the Donald J. Trump Foundation, which turns out to be improper, I really don't think you can hang that on Pam Bondi, though it's a question why she waited so long to return it. She waited until March of this year.
Yeah.
And that foundation is not allowed to make contributions.
Let me bring in Matt Dixon to that last point here, Steve, because the check to Bondi was returned to the Trump Foundation in March, what, 2 years after it was originally written? Is that about right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And the foundation didn't accept it.
Right. Right. That is the foundation itself is a nonprofit. So what they had said at the, I guess, the New York level or wherever it's based, one of their folks up there who deals with requests like this for contributions sort of wrote it from the wrong area, the wrong account. And it ended up being a nonprofit where they couldn't do that. And I think that's, you know, obviously she tried to give it back and it was, you know, several years later. So there's questions about the timeline. But I think to me one of the most striking things is the fact that we're able to kind of have this conversation and the fact that AP got someone on the record to say this. It's campaign contributions are often asked for by political candidates.
Right.
It's a fairly normal course of business. But the idea that one of these consultants went on the record and said yes, especially in the midst of this controversy, I think is sort of one of the more striking details of this. The idea that it wasn't a background conversation or sort of a you know, a wink wink. The idea we have a quote and we can sort of talk about this openly is money in politics isn't new, but this dynamic is certainly novel.
Yeah, the confirmation here coming from this political advisor that Pam Bondi personally solicited a donation from Donald J. Trump during her reelection campaign to continue to serve as the Florida Attorney General. Steve Bosquet, you've been around politics a good long time. We know politicians ask for money in various different forms. Is the size of this personal solicitation different? Is the fact that it's these two people, a sitting top prosecutor and a top real estate developer who had been under investigation for his or her his involvement in a fraud investigation, is that what makes makes this so juicy?
Well, is the size of the contribution unusual? Sadly, no. As a matter of fact, this is on the low side. Most every legislator and state official has a political committee. They fly under the radar in a ghastly loophole in the campaign finance system in Florida, in my judgment, in which they can take unlimited amounts of money from people. It's got to be reported and disclosed, but it creates the potential for massive conflicts like this. What's significant here is this, I think. It feeds into a whole bunch of narratives, and it has Bondi in a lot of bad places politically, because you've got the Trump University ongoing class action cases alleging deceptive trade practices and fraud. You've got Trump running for president. You've got the background of Pam Bondi. This is not the first time she's had a problem regarding fundraising and perceived conflicts. There was an episode in the 2014 reelection. Her 2014 reelection campaign, where she had apologized belatedly, but apologized because she asked that an execution of a serial killer be rescheduled because it conflicted with a fundraiser.
Right. We received obviously plenty of criticism for putting politics ahead of her duties as a prosecutor. Matt Dixon with Politico, not necessarily a significant amount of money here, the contribution, the $25,000 contribution that Pam Bondi's political action committee received. Not unusual for a sitting politician to solicit a donation, but the personalities here are certainly outsized, and the timing of this, of course, is certainly interesting. And Pam Bondi, after the Associated Press reported that on Monday, came out on Tuesday saying that the timing of the donation, $25,000, a matter of days within her decision, her office's decision to not participate in a fraud and deceptive trade practices investigation into Trump University. How much weight is behind those? How much are we, you know, looking for causation or perhaps something else?
Well, reporters for a few days, or I guess maybe probably a couple of weeks at this point, have sort of been splitting hairs with General Bondi's office over if we use the word investigation. They say there was never an investigation. They try to distance themselves from the idea that they were even considering it. There happened to be some complaints here in Florida that were also involved in a separate attorney general's investigation up in New York. And she acknowledges, obviously, that that's a matter of public record, that those were there. But she's been very much publicly trying to distance herself from the idea that she was even considering investigating, and that allows her to say, well, we didn't drop an investigation or drop a consideration of the investigation. We simply had these complaints and didn't move forward. So it's been a sort of maddening exercise in semantics over the past 2 weeks, but it certainly has kept us on the phone with annoyed press shops.
Yeah, words mean something certainly here. Matt Dixon with Politico, Steve Bosquet covering politics for the Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about the Attorney General in the state of Florida, Pam Bondi, and a $25,000 political contribution that was given to her reelection political action committee several years ago by one Donald J. Trump, who was under investigation in other states for his involvement in Trump University. Let's go to the phones here in Hollywood. Brian joins the Florida Roundup. Brian, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. Does anybody on your panel know Donald Trump's connection to this Trump University? What I'm wondering is, I've seen him put his name or loan his name or sell his name to developers here in Florida. Could this have been one of those kinds of arrangements? How much involved was he in the day-to-day transactions? Was he making these decisions, or did he just get his name attached to a bunch of bad actors? I'd be curious to know if anybody in your panel knows, you know, his connection to these people.
Let's put that to the panel, Brian. Appreciate it. Matt or Steve, any sense of kind of the real involvement with Trump in Trump University?
I've read some of the filings by the New York Attorney General. I mean, Trump has done infomercials for Trump University. Without the Donald Trump name and that cachet, there really isn't very much. So did he personally attend the seminars and all that stuff? I doubt it. But he's been, you know, he's going to be deposed again by the Attorney General. The big class action, of course, is in California, which is why Judge Curiel has been in the news so much.
Right. And
well,
is
at it, the heart, at,
go ahead, Matt Dixon.
Well, at the heart of some of those lawsuits, and they're still ongoing, is the that very idea that it was pitched to potential students or whatever, you know, clients, and is Donald Trump picking the staff, picking the teachers, picking the faculty, and down to that level, and they're alleging that no, that did not happen, and you know that's still part of ongoing legal actions.
But he certainly was involved enough to be deposed at least once and to be named in the lawsuit, and clearly this is. This is a lawsuit, a burr that's gotten under the skin of Donald Trump with the class action lawsuit in California. So there is more involvement than simply that Trump name. But, Steve, I think to your point, if it weren't called Trump University, if it were Smith University or Jones University, it may be a different story altogether here. Right. Back to the issue with the attorney general in Florida here and the issue of this political contribution and the timing. Matt, semantics aside, investigation, no investigation by her office in 2013. There were complaints in the state of Florida against Trump University, complaining against deceptive trade practices and other issues around the promises and pledges that Trump University had toward its clients. Where do those stand now? Are those still within the AG's office?
No, I mean, they weren't acted upon. And she points to another point of pushback from the attorney general's office is that most of them, there were certainly consumer complaints. Nobody is denying that. But most of them, I believe all but one, she points to were filed under the attorney general before her. Mm-hmm. And there's now that they released, I guess it was roughly, 8,000 pages of documents related to this. And reporters are starting to call through them and to see if there was additional or what exactly the intersection there is. But they decided not to act on the consumer complaints that, you know, everyone acknowledges were indeed here in Florida.
Pam Bondi has said that she chooses her political endorsements in a, quote, very personal way. Steve Bosquet, she was, I believe, the highest and first elected official in Florida to put her political muscle behind the presidential hopes of Donald Trump. Why?
Yeah, well, let me say this. Pam Bondi was a very early and big supporter of Jeb Bush. We all went to a big event here in Tallahassee maybe a year and a half ago where Pam was basically the master of ceremonies. A lot of people, 300 people there. So she was a Bush person out of the gate and decided to support Donald Trump. She wants to be in the victors of, winner's circle parade. She can't run again for attorney general. Mm-hmm. She has indicated she doesn't want to run for another office. I think what we should keep in mind here are a couple of things. Pam Bondi's a very important and valuable surrogate for Donald Trump in this state. Pam Bondi won two races for attorney general easily. She is the only woman who holds statewide office in the state. She's telegenic. She's been on Fox News a lot and may have a future in that regard as well. She's also the chief legal officer and the chief consumer advocate for this state, which is why this Trump University stuff is so disturbing to a lot of people. But Trump's got a big, big rally in downtown Tampa on Saturday morning. I would expect Pam Bondi would be there along with Governor Rick Scott. And she's going to be a visible person in Trump's campaign.
So in that regard, Matt Dixon, does this story back in the headlines, back on the airwaves, ding her political wherewithal, her political weight that she could lend to the Trump campaign in Florida?
Well, I think the segment of the electorate that Donald Trump has been speaking to with those the people who have been with him and supporting him, the 40% or so that were with him in the primary. No, I really don't think so. Steve is absolutely right. She's a great surrogate here in Florida and going to be very important for him. And I don't think some of these things are going to impact the Trump supporters who've been there from day one. And, you know, it could impact his ability to expand the folks he needs to win here in Florida and expand his supporter base, which is obviously going to be very important moving to the general election. And we'll see, because his opponents have and her opponents immediately upon the endorsement wanted to get this check from 2013 right back in the news cycle. As soon as the endorsement happened, there were organizations issuing statements saying, you know, kind of, hey, guys, remember this? And that was a very clear indication that it was something that was going to be part of this, you know, conversation after General Bondi endorsed Trump.
Yeah, Bondi could shore up the support that Trump has in Florida, but is she going to be able to help bring over the independents in Florida to a Trump Republican nomination and a Trump Republican run in November, Steve Bosquet? The independents, as we know, that's the fastest growing political party in the state of Florida, if not the United States. That's the portion that Trump and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton are going to fight over. And what role does Pam Bondi have in that fight?
That's unclear to me. I mean, I think you're right. Donald Trump's got a problem with women voters, just like Hillary Clinton does with men voters.
Yeah.
We know that, and poll after poll. So I think that, you know, I think that Trump goes out into places where there are independent voters, and the independent voting, the segment of voters in the electorate in Florida who are of no party is approaching 30%.
Yeah.
Big, big group of people.
Finally, let me bring it back down to this $25,000 contribution here. There are calls this week, renewed calls for a state investigation. Is there any water here to be held, Steve Busquet? Is there any kind of effort that is going to gain favor amongst some investigative body?
I'm skeptical. I think that this kind of thing goes on a lot. That is, in terms of soliciting campaign contributions. Can you prove a quid pro quo? Can you prove that Bondi lost, or Bondi's people, you know, developed no enthusiasm for the Trump University complaints because she got a check from Trump's foundation? I'm skeptical of that. Would someone who holds an office that Bondi holds sell her office out for $25,000? I have no doubt that if Pam Bondi were sitting in the studio, this is the ugliest $25,000 contribution that a state official in the state has gotten in a very long time. And the irony is she ended up donating. Matt Dixon's a great political numbers of campaign finance numbers guy, but I looked the other day, she donated like $2 million to the Republican Party of Florida.
Yeah.
She didn't need this money.
Yeah.
Well, and especially since she has no real – but she hasn't – the committee we're talking about hasn't raised money since January. She's not running for anything in the near future, so
yeah.
It's, you know, it's an element as well.
So ultimately, what happened to this 25 grand? She tried to give it back to the foundation. The foundation refused to accept it. Dollars are fungible, but what happened to it?
I think it went in a big pot of money that went to the Republican Party of Florida that was used to help Republican candidates win up and down the ballot in 2014.
And once a contribution is given to a statewide party, so much money goes in and out, and you don't have to, or I guess you can't in a lot of ways, earmark specifically where it goes. So once a contribution is made to a party, it's sort of a campaign finance black hole, and it's anyone's guess on if it's was paid to gas up cars to drive around the state or to, you know, help candidates.
I think this does hand an issue to the Democrats in the 2018 cycle, when there'll be a new attorney general in this state.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have to come up with a good candidate, which Democrats aren't very good at doing. But the Bondi situation has undoubtedly, in my mind, created an argument that there needs to be a much thicker firewall between the political side of the office, the fundraising side, and what goes on in terms of, you know, actually protecting consumers.
Steve Busquet, veteran political reporter from the Tampa Bay Times, along with Matt Dixon from Politico, both of them with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us here on the Florida Roundup today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, do you support continuing the trade embargo against Cuba? Line those calls in now, 800-743-WLRN. The trade embargo, Cuba, and the role of Panama in helping Cuba get around the trade embargo. 800-743-9576 is the phone number. How the Cuban government has used Panama and a law firm there involved in the Panama Papers to get around the trade embargo. That's next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. The Panama Papers leak has shown a light on abusive and questionable practices of using offshore financial maneuvering to skirt around rules involving money. And that now includes the arms of the Cuban government getting around the half-century-old U.S. trade embargo. El Nuevo Herald reported this week more than two dozen companies registered in the Caribbean have links to Cuba, companies that helped Cuba and hundreds of millions of dollars slip through the American trade ban. Does this surprise you? Does it change how you may feel about the embargo? And how does it impact efforts on Capitol Hill and Congress to reduce or eliminate the trade embargo? Line up the calls now, 800-743-WLRN. The trade embargo and Cuba, the United States, and the Panama Papers, 800-743-9576 on social media, Facebook, and on Twitter. Nora Yamez Torres is with our partner, the Miami Herald, El Nuevo Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Nora, first of all, remind us of what these Panama Papers are.
Oh, hi, Tom. This is a collection of documents that has been leaked to some media and also like a consortium of investigative journalists mm-hmm. around the world. And in the papers, we found actually 25 of these companies with links to Cuba.
And describe what those links are. It gets very complex very quickly. It's a spider web of limited liability corporations and blind corporations. But generally speaking, how are these companies set up with their links back to Cuba? And what are those links to Cuba? To the government?
Yeah, there are two ways in which they are related to Cuba. One is that they are related to Cuban state companies. And we know that because of all the documents that are linking back to Havana and to Cuba officials. And then the other relation is that sometimes foreign companies also use these offshore companies in Bahamas, in Panama, to sell and buy things from Cuba.
I want to walk through an example that you gave this week involving that second sample, a foreign company that used offshore firms set up by this Panamanian law firm to kind of skirt around the trade embargo. It was a Lebanese company that has a subsidiary in Cuba and a subsidiary in the United States in Texas. What did it do?
Well, we prove, you know, without doubt that they have connections with this big conglomerate, BB Energy, that sells oil around the world, although they deny it. And so basically they created this office in Havana to sell Russian oil, maybe to Cuba, maybe to other countries in Latin America. We still, you know, are not sure of, you know, what the role of Cuba was. But Cuba was part of this triangulation of oil coming from Russia using this Lebanese company.
Right. And this was the Lebanese company set up a firm in Panama that had an office in Havana that then Russian oil and dollars, currency, flowed through this third party. This is back in the 1990s, of course, after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And in the meantime, this same Lebanese company had another company that was based in the United States.
Yeah, well, this company in the United States I found, it's more recent. But still, the office and the company in Cuba is still active. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you have this company that has, at the same time, it's doing business with the U.S. and it's doing business with Cuba.
So in this regard, where is there a violation of the trade embargo here in this example?
Well, experts said that there might be a violation because you need a license. You need a special permission from the U.S. government to trade with Cuba.
Even a Lebanese company with a Panamanian subsidiary needs an American license to trade with Cuba?
The U.S. company would need that.
The U.S. company would need that.
Or if the U.S. company has some sort of other subsidiaries.
Right.
It's using some sort of intermediary. They still need the license.
And this is where, I mean, obviously, it's very complex here. But if you have two separate subsidiaries here, the question becomes, does the subsidiary in the United States of this Lebanese company have any relation to the Panamanian subsidiary of the Lebanese company?
Yeah, sure. I think the main issue here is to prove that the subsidiary in Havana, it's owned by the same company that owns the subsidiary in the U.S. And in this case, that's what the Panama paper shows, that there are clear links with.
And once you follow these branches back to that tree root, in this case, the Lebanese company, therein lies the potential violation of the trade embargo, Nora. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And these companies, what other than were they set up as you walked through the Panama Papers, were they set up precisely to get around the American trade embargo, or perhaps that subversion of the trade embargo was just a consequence of doing global financial business?
Well, in the case of the Cuban companies, of the Cuban state companies, they were set up exactly to do that, to get around embargo, because that way they can use U.S. dollars, which was not allowed until very recently. So they could not use a dollar unless they hide that the company was actually Cuban.
Yeah, and what we're talking about here is actual American currency, U.S. dollars,
exactly,
as opposed to euros or Canadian dollars or Kiwi dollars from New Zealand, whatever it may be.
Exactly. So for them, it was critical just to hide that these were Cuban companies.
Yeah. And what were they used for, these Cuban companies that the Panama Papers lines up as front companies, essentially, for agencies of the Cuban government to use American currency? What were they trading? What was happening?
The trade included food, medical products, tobacco, carrying out fishing activities, selling computers, you know, you name it.
Yeah. And a lot of these things, in terms of food and just basic necessities, you know, we've come to learn through history. The 90s obviously was very threadbare within the Cuban economy. And even today, Cuba imports a majority of its food. So were these set up by a necessity in order to help continue to feed the Cuban people?
Yeah, you probably can say that. But also, like, there are some sort of exceptions to the embargo, including food and medical products,
right.
Actually.
Right.
So one of the other cases we found is this American company that used an intermediary to sell medical products to Cuba, when in fact they could have applied for a license, because I talked to some of the officials at the Department of Treasury and Commerce, and they say there's a general policy of approval for licenses to export medical products. So then you have these other cases in which we're not sure why the company didn't apply for permission.
Now, these separate companies that were set up by the Cuban government, set up outside of Cuba, legally not Cuban. They're domiciled in the British Virgin Islands or some other Caribbean country. So technically, within even the spirit of the law, are they still violating the trade embargo?
Well, I'm not sure about the Cuban companies themselves. I think probably the fine or the possible fines or the possible cases in which the government might want to open an investigation will be focused on these other foreign companies with links to the U.S. that were trading with Cuba without license. Mm. About what could happen to these Cuban companies, we really don't know.
Nora Yamez Torres is with our partner, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. And Nora, as you know, there's legislation in Congress that would eliminate more restrictions on Americans engaging with Cuba, encourage more economic engagement, including dropping the travel ban or even perhaps doing away with the entire trade embargo. Back in March, WLRN spoke with Minnesota Republican Representative Tom Emmer. Mm-hmm. He had just returned from Cuba at this time, and he had put his support behind a bill to end the trade embargo. Here's what he told us.
Are there communists in Cuba? Sure. And is the government still controlled by the Castros? It appears so. But I was introduced to the Cuban people, who clearly are hungry to be exposed beyond Cuba. So if you truly want to help the Cuban people, if you truly want to give them an opportunity someday to self-determine, to address the human rights issues, it all starts with lifting the embargo.
So, Nora, how do you think the revelations that you report this week in El Nuevo Herald and Miami Herald regarding the Panama Papers and the use of this Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca by the Cuban government to perhaps subvert and get around the trade embargo, how do you think this could impact these congressional efforts to drop the embargo?
Well, you know, on one hand, it shows that the embargo was not that efficient in stopping the Cuban government, you know, doing trading. On the other hand, it might help some congressmen that support, you know, lifting the embargo by saying, okay, here's this policy. It was not very effective, and it's hurting the Cuban people. Mm-hmm. And even Mossack Fonseca, you know, we found, like, records of them, you know, assessing, okay, what we should do with these Cuban companies. We might be breaking embargo, but you know what? Like, the embargo is probably going soon. And that's why they keep giving services to these companies with links to Cuba. So I'm not sure if this is going to hurt or help these efforts in Congress. But recently, yes, there has been a push for some of this legislation to leave the travel ban and some other trading parts of the embargo, which has been very relaxed. It has been relaxed lately by the Obama administration. So we're talking a very different embargo nowadays.
Yeah, that's very true. And finally, I want to ask you about some of the evidence you found in the papers regarding the Cuban government making capital investments, making direct investments in foreign companies through these offshore firms, mm-hmm. not just setting up third-party offshore companies to trade in food or trade in medical supplies, but to essentially take Cuban government money and invest in companies.
Yeah, I think that's the most one of the most interesting parts. And unfortunately, these type of investigations and reports are not, you know, published or circulating as much as we like to in the island, when the Cubans could ask their own government, okay, what are you doing with this money, and when, why you didn't tell us, and, you know, what are you doing with, because this is state budget. So that's the most intriguing part. We don't know really what some of these companies were doing with the money.
And what do you think the response could be on the island of these revelations that you've uncovered in the Panama Papers?
Well, so far the Cuban state media have remained silent because, you know, clearly some people on the island knew that this was going on, but we never found, like, the proof of these old transactions. But there was always the rumor that the government was investing abroad and was doing trading, you know, to go around the U.S. embargo and so forth. So I would like to see, like, what they got, the state media says. And we ask for comment, of course, from the U.S., the Cuban embassy in Washington, yes. Yeah. But they didn't reply to us.
Nora Yamez Torres, behind a wonderful report with our partner, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald, detailing the involvement of the Cuban government getting around the U.S. trade embargo with the help of the Panamanian law firm at the center of the Panama Papers. Nora, great to have you back on the Florida Roundup. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Still to come, plenty more. Stick around. Have you rented or bought a condominium recently? Did you pay an application fee? How much was that? Let us know. Did you get ripped off? 800-743-WLRN. Line the phone calls up now. Condominium, real estate, application fees. 800-743-9576. What kind of shape is the housing market in? It's all next. Real estate on the Florida Roundup. That's still to come. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. It certainly isn't headline news that the South Florida real estate market is costly for both buyers and renters. But a Miami Herald investigation has found that many condo associations are charging more than they're allowed under law for application fees. There are a variety of costs condo boards can charge new residents that come with names like application fees, transfer fees, moving charges, even deposits on pets. That all add to the high cost of living here in South Florida. Meantime, the overall market is slowing down. It's still going up in value, but it is slowing down, and fewer homeowners are underwater with their mortgages. So here we are in the Florida Roundup, real estate and the cost of housing. Have you paid an application fee to rent or buy a condominium, a pet deposit? Let us know what your experiences have been. How much did you pay? Is your home value going up? Are you waiting to buy, hoping that prices will drop? 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can also find us at WLRN on Twitter and on Facebook. Nicholas Nehamas covers real estate for our partner, the Miami Herald, and Ina Cordell watching all things real estate for The Real Deal. Nick joins us via the telephone. Nick, first of all, explain this investigation into application fees. What did you find?
Right. So we found that in violation of a state law that caps the amount condos can charge people to apply or move in at $100, that many condos in Broward and especially Miami-Dade are charging people up to $650. You know, the costs are meant to cover background checks and interviews and, you know, all the costs that go into vetting someone to move into a building. But state law is very clear here. The association should only be charging $100 per person or married couple, and there's just widespread violation of that law.
Nick, I'm going to warn you here. I'm going to parse that statement, and I know that you've already had it parsed. The association can charge $100 under the state law, but what about the association's management firm or the association's security firm?
Yes, that's an argument that the attorneys for the management companies have been making, that if the fees are paid to the management company, the law doesn't apply. However, the Division of Condos has ruled that it's just if the association is requiring you to pay a fee, that's a so-called transfer fee, which is the the broader name.
So it doesn't matter who the check is made out to, if it's the association itself, if it's the association management company, if it's the background security fee, if it's the pet deposit cleaning service, whatever it is, if it's required by the association documents in order to move in, that's considered the fee under the law.
That's correct. Now, deposits are different. They can charge deposits, but if it's a fee and it's more than $100, no matter who is charging it, it's illegal.
And where does this extra money go?
Well, it you know, partly goes to the associations themselves, and it goes to the management companies to cover their costs. You know, a lot of the management companies say it costs more than $100 to do a background check on someone who's from overseas, so they're planning to lobby the state legislature to actually raise this cap.
Yeah. This is a flat fee that was put in place, what, a couple of decades ago?
Yeah, it was $50, I think, in the 70s, and then in the early 90s, they raised it up to 100 per person or married couple.
And your investigation here, Nick, found some of the worst offenders. You looked at multiple listing service, MLS data, which is the database that the industry uses if you got a property to sell or rent. 65% listed in Doral had a fee over $100. 56% in North Miami had a fee listed over $100. 55% in Hialeah. 50% in Sunny Isles. But this was something you found really throughout South Florida.
Yes, it was very widespread. Interesting, you know, like in Doral, where there are more foreign buyers, we found more condos in violation. And, you know, it's important to remember that the MLS is entered by realtors, not by condo associations. So several real estate experts, realtors and brokers I interviewed, said they think it's even higher than what we found.
Ina Cordell, you've covered real estate here in South Florida for a good long time. You're with The Real Deal now. This is yet another cost, another indication of the cost of living here in paradise on the strip of land squeezed between the Atlantic Ocean and the Everglades. But the value of that land continues to go up. We've seen some pretty decent numbers. How is residential real estate locally?
Well, Tom, the data for April has recently come out. CoreLogic did their research, and homes in Miami-Dade County were up 7.1% in April compared to April 2015, and up 1.4% compared to March. That's still a far cry from the double-digit increases that we saw last year.
Yeah.
But it's still rising.
Still rising. So the pace of an increase is slowing down, but we're still going
exactly
forward. So we're no longer going 50 miles an hour. We're going 42
exactly
miles an hour forward.
Exactly.
Still moving forward.
Exactly.
In the meantime, fewer people are underwater in their mortgages as well. That spells good things here.
Right. Along with the rising value of homes, the mortgages are, the underwater mortgages are declining. Miami-Dade was considered number one in the country for quite some time.
Yeah.
Now we just dropped to number two after Las Vegas. 13%, I'm sorry, I believe it was 19.6% are currently underwater. And that fell 5.8 percentage points year over year.
Yeah, that's good. So fewer people owe more than their homes are worth. That's the state of the local real estate market. Do you feel it in your pocketbook? Join our conversation here, 800-743-9576. On the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Let's go to line two. Gazelle is joining us from Miami. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Two comments. I'm living, I own my property in Miami, and I'm looking to relocate to Orlando. And I found two things, because I struggled between whether I was going to sell the house or rent it. I found that my home now has accrued all this equity. It was just, wow, that's great. But then I went to try and relocate to Orlando and found all those hidden fees that I don't, you know, I know to pay my mortgage. I don't know about this. $100 association fees. There's $65 per person living in the home that has to be checked. And I have a dog. They have a fee. So by the time everything is said and done, without paying the monthly rent and the security, I would have spent about $500 just on the process of getting approved, which I think is
exorbitant.
Giselle, it sounds like you're experiencing in Orlando, Nick, what you found here in South Florida.
Yeah, $500 is not unexceptional. And, you know, as the caller points out, this is a real burden for, you know, middle and working class people. You know, one of the attorneys we interviewed said that, you know, the cost of renting or owning a condo in South Florida is expensive enough without associations fleecing residents, without illegal fees. Important to note, however, that this state law that caps the fees at $100 per person only applies to condo associations. If our caller is applying to a homeowners association, then she will be stuck having to pay those fees.
Good to know. And Ina, it does add to that cost of living here, a cost that we know, even with the higher property values, continues to be very expensive, certainly in the state of Florida, if not in the southeastern U.S.
Right. Rents are also increasing,
yeah,
steadily increasing. And Miami now ranks number 8 in the country in terms of the highest rents.
So, very significant here. Let's go to Sunrise. Vinette joins the Florida Roundup. Go ahead. Nice to hear from you. Vinette, you with us?
Hello.
Hey, there you go. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm sorry. How are you? Yes, I just wanted to say that my mom passed away. She left her condo, which is totally, there's no balance due. It's mortgage-free. She left the condo as a life estate for my siblings and I. There are 5 of us. The condo is requiring a $150 application fee, you know, from each one of us.
For each one of you who live in the same condo?
No one lives there right now because we all have our own homes, but my mom's records need to be changed on the condo documents, you know, so no one has really submitted an application. So the fee, I think, it's you know, ridiculous.
And that $150 fee is spelled out in the condominium documents, the paperwork from the association?
Yes, their application process. And my sister, who will be moving down, she wants to stay there for maybe about 2 months, you know, so they can find a home here. They're relocating from New York.
Vinette, Nick, it sounds like a textbook violation that you write about in the Herald, Nick.
It doesn't. Tom, you bring up a good point. You know, not only is there a cap at $100, but also in the association's governing documents, the association must give itself the right to approve transfers of condos and also must set the fee. So if that language isn't in the association documents, and those are public records that our listeners can pull, then the fee is illegal no matter, you know, if it's $10, $20, $50, $100, $150. So, you know, I would encourage everyone dealing with this situation to contact the State Division of Condominiums, Timeshares and Mobile Homes, which regulates these issues, or the Florida State Attorney General.
Ina Cordell with The Real Deal. We may be talking about $20 difference in what state law allows and what an association is charging, a $50 difference, a $100 difference. But when you've got a building of 400 units, that adds up pretty quickly. When you've got a community built upon condominiums, like some of our communities are, that adds up to a lot of kind of household income that is taken out of the economy in an area which depends upon the ability of real estate transactions to happen in order to kind of, you know, grease this local economy. So what shape, broadly speaking, is your assessment of the housing market here? How are we doing?
Well, you know, there's been so much construction of new condominium buildings that have catered to foreign investors to a large extent, and that now has fallen off. It's a slowdown in the market from foreign investment in particular. And there's just so much, you know, the housing market is just growing so fast here that those amounts that you're talking about are just multiplying considerably.
And what we've heard about the slowdown, right, is it's going to be different this time. No longer are valets and busboys able to buy a pre-construction home with no money down. Instead, builders are requiring 50% deposits on new condominiums. Lenders are much more scrutinized in terms of the amount of down payment that that buyers are going to have to come to the closing table with.
True. We found a few exceptions to that. There are some buildings, particularly in the Brickell area, that are nearly sold out, where they've dropped the condominium deposits considerably to as low as about 30%, because they say they're almost sold out, and now they want to cater to a domestic buyer. Domestic buyers have never been, you know, comfortable or been used to paying a 50% deposit.
Or able to in some cases.
Exactly.
Yeah, and a domestic buyer, we're talking about buyers from the Northeast. We're not talking about buyers in Miami-Dade County coming from Broward County. Those are the domestic buyers that local developers are going after are outside of South Florida.
Right. Yeah. For condominiums, they're particularly second homes, vacation homes.
A real estate and costs here in South Florida. Ina Cordell with The Real Deal with us, and from our partner, the Miami Herald, Nicholas Nehamas as well. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Finally on the Roundup this week, remembering the sweet science and poet who never held back a punch, an appreciation of the poetry of Muhammad Ali. Here's Scott Cunningham, the founder and director of O Miami.
Muhammad Ali was a poet, but he didn't write poems so that they could get lost in books. He wrote poems that were meant to be recited out loud by one man, himself, which is a good lesson for any aspiring poet. It's easy to breathe in the Delphi-like fumes of poetry's seriousness and start to sound like a James Earl Jones impersonator, or like you're carving a Hallmark card into granite. Ali's publishing forum, a television camera and a microphone, left no space for such self-obscurity, nor did his sense of purpose. Poetry was the way he sparred with a white audience who disapproved of him. Like his most formidable opponent, George Foreman, Ali's audience presumably had the power in their relationship. They made the rules. They had the money. If they hated him so much, why didn't they just stop tuning in, buying tickets, and placing bets? If you're facing the hardest puncher in the history of the sport, what do? You let him hit you. If your audience hates that you talk too much, you talk more, and you speak in a genre that they feel belongs to them. What, after all, could be whiter than poetry? A mandatory school subject, replete with dead European men and force-fed to children as a moral value, poetry was the perfect medium for Ali to turn the mainstream culture against itself. He didn't write prose poems in cutting-edge beatnik parlance. He wrote poems in old, traditional forms, couplets and ballads with hard, crunchy end rhymes and meters that would have made Yeats stand up and clap. Clay swings with the left.
Clay swings with his right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight.
Ali put earworms of his own mythos into the airwaves, where even his greatest detractors could not resist them.
This thing keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time. Aaron Clay lost the boom.
He was called the fifth Beatle as an insult, but it was an appropriate moniker. Both Beatle and Boxer made catchy tunes you couldn't get out of your head, and that ring forever truer and louder than the prosaic criticism of their detractors.
Now listen, disappears from view. The crowd is getting frantic, but our radar stations have picked him up. He's somewhere over the Atlantic.
Ali exhibited all the skills of a great poet. He was a master of metaphor, performance, and improvisation.
Who would have thought when they came to the fight that they witnessed the launching of a human satellite?
Speaking to a reporter before his 1964 bout with Sonny Liston, Ali said, "People think I talk too much. That's why I got these." And he held up his fists. The reporter daftly replied, "And they represent your thinking?" Without missing a beat, Ali said, "They represent dynamite." And then made the sound of dynamite exploding.
Yes, the crowd did not dream when they put down their money that they would see a total eclipse of the sun.
Poetry has rarely been as much fun since. I'm Scott Cunningham.
Scott Cunningham is the founder of O Miami. Muhammad Ali is laid to rest today, Friday, in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky.
Muhammad, Muhammad Ali, he floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee. Muhammad, the black Superman, who calls to the other guy. Catch me if you can.
That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Thanks to all our callers. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien, Gina Jordan, and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Thank you, Paul. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.